It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a mathematician brings together geometry, law, and political science to take on partisan redistricting. We'll find out more. First, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments for a Wisconsin case that could have a nationwide impact. The case looks at the lengths lawmakers can go to when redrawing district lines for partisan advantage. Wisconsin Democrats argue that the last time districts were redrawn in the state, they were extremely skewed in Republicans' favor, and it should be considered unconstitutional. The court is reported to be divided on that matter as of right now. WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is in Washington, D.C., covering this case. Sean, how's it going?
It's going well, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
So taking a look at what you've seen so far, give us a general sense of what you've heard today.
So what we heard today is kind of what we suspected, I guess, going into arguments. And you know, I should say that attorneys always caution against reading too much into what justices say from the bench, that it is their job in that brief 1 hour oral argument window to be skeptical, to get their questions out of the way. You know, they have that very small period of time in which to do so. That said, the questions and statements that you heard from justices on the U.S. Supreme Court today seem to reinforce kind of where we thought they might be when it comes to whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court can strike down a legislative map as a partisan gerrymander. That is, whether or not the court can say that a political party in Wisconsin, it was Republicans, drew a map that was so partisan that it violated the constitutional rights of the other party, in this case, the Democrats, in the process.
Now, based on the remarks that the justices have made today, it sounds as though several justices leaning in favor of a decision toward the plaintiffs, others looking at it as something that hasn't been fully ironed out. Justice Neil Gorsuch on that side, and in the middle, we think maybe Justice Kennedy. Can you lay out the landscape there with the justices?
Sure. So there are 9 justices on the court, and as of right now, we have a split between 5 justices who were nominated by Republican presidents, 4 justices who were nominated by Democratic presidents. And take the justices who were nominated by Democrats first. Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, they all sounded in their remarks as though they were open to striking down this map. Ginsburg said at one point they, Republicans, achieved the map that was the most partisan, and it worked. She said it exceeded expectations. She questioned what would it mean for democracy if the court doesn't get involved in striking down partisan gerrymandering cases or get involved in partisan gerrymandering claims if people start to think that, you know, that the sacred vote doesn't mean all that much because who's going to win is, laid out when they draw the district lines. On the other side of the court, you had conservative justices, Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Samuel Alito, Justice Neil Gorsuch, all sounded skeptical that the Supreme Court should wade into an issue like this. Roberts in particular said that if the court does this, then you're going to see case after case brought to justices based on the idea that there was a partisan gerrymander and that the court's going to be asked to take sides, that they're going to have to side with the Democrats or the Republicans. And even if they base those decisions on math and social science, that the average person on the street's going to say that the court sided with the Republicans or the Democrats. And Roberts said that's going to cause some serious harm to the status and integrity of the court in the eyes of the country.
Now, Sean, there have been challenges to redistricting efforts before. What makes this case unique?
In a way, this is kind of the latest go-round. I mean, it's unique because 13 years have passed since the last redistricting case. And in that last go-around, you had a similar ideological split on the court, 5-4. You had Justice Anthony Kennedy in the middle, who we didn't talk about just now, but Justice Anthony Kennedy was seen as the swing vote in 2004. He is seen as the swing vote today. And in 2004, he wrote that, he wasn't ready to strike down that particular map. It was a Pennsylvania case based on a partisan gerrymandering claim, but that gerrymandering was a serious issue and that a future court should be open to that kind of a verdict if they could come up with a workable metric, you know, a consistent way to measure these things and a bright line measure so that we know, so that courts know, so that legislators know when they've crossed that line and become too partisan and violated constitutional rights of the other party. Kennedy sits in the middle of, on this court. He didn't say much today. He asked some questions. He was the first to ask questions, actually. But they involved standing. They involved, you know, whether or not the case would be viewed differently if it were more of a First Amendment case versus a 14th Amendment case, you know, an equal protection case versus a free speech case. He asked about, you know, hypotheticals about whether or not plaintiffs would have standing if, you know, the right to do partisan gerrymanders was written into state constitutions or state laws. You know, maybe the attorneys heard something in there that told them, aha, we know where Kennedy's headed with this. But it seemed like he was kind of playing his cards close to his vest.
We're talking with Sean Johnson right now, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief in Washington, D.C. right now, looking at the Wisconsin redistricting case that's being heard in the U.S. Supreme Court. And Sean, you said that Justice Kennedy has seemed to suggest that he's willing to consider a reliable metric about whether or not a district has has undergone partisan redistricting. Has a metric like that been presented to the court yet?
They've got a range of options in front of them. So in the past, when we've talked about this case, we've talked a lot about this new metric that was developed, kind of with this case in mind, called the efficiency gap. And the efficiency gap measures wasted votes. That is, you know, when Democrats, we'll use a Wisconsin case, for example, in a hypothetical Wisconsin district. If Democrats win 80% of the vote in a strongly Democratic district, they're wasting a lot of those votes. Put that in quotations, wasting a lot of those votes because those votes are not contributing to them winning that seat. They voted more than they needed to for that seat. Or if they come up short in a more competitive race, They wasted those votes. Essentially, what the efficiency gap does is looks at those, you know, wasted votes for both parties, compares it to the statewide vote total, and comes up with a number. And that's supposed to be a way to consistently compare maps, not only current in the United States, but over the past several decades. And by that metric, Wisconsin had one of the most partisan gerrymanders of the last 40 years. Now, plaintiffs are not saying that is the be-all, end-all of tests, as, you know, we talk about this case here today. They're now kind of taking the approach that the court could approach this differently and ask different questions and use different metrics to decide whether or not a map is partisan or too partisan. That kind of gets at the heart of this issue. You know, the court is looking for that one consistent measure. Plaintiffs are saying we have a bunch now, and, you know, this is really refined social science now. Critics, and it sounds like critics on the Supreme Court are saying, you know, you're making it a bit confusing, a bit obscure. How are people supposed to know? Justice Gorsuch compared it to a secret steak rub, where only he knows the ingredients and they might change from time to time. So that's kind of where we're at. The court's still trying to decide whether it can have that consistent measure. Some of the justices are hinting they found it. Some are saying not so much.
And Sean, this is being billed as a landmark case. What nationwide implications could it have?
What could happen if the plaintiffs prevail in this case, in the Wisconsin case? First, for Wisconsin, it's going to mean we're going to have likely a more competitive map, a map that has the potential to elect more Democrats and fewer Republicans. Nationally, you would see lawsuits like this repeated in other states that had, you know, single party control, that had arguably partisan gerrymanders. They would try their hand at a partisan gerrymandering claim like what happened in Wisconsin, and you could see other maps potentially overturned. The flip side of that is if the Supreme Court says, once again, look, this is a serious problem, but courts can't get involved in this. We can't get involved in this case. We're going to uphold Wisconsin's map, and we're not going to get involved in partisan gerrymandering cases. Plaintiffs say that would send a message around the country that, you know, legislatures can do what they want when it comes to this, and that the gerrymanders of today are not your father's gerrymanders. They're more sophisticated. They're more driven by math and computers and can get more precise. And that in the year 2020, after, you know, when the next round of redistricting comes around, that you'll see gerrymanders like you've never seen before in the U.S. and a more partisan country.
And Sean, as we wrap up, what's next?
What's next is we wait, and we're not sure how long we're going to wait. Court watchers say you can expect the court will have a decision by the end of its, you know, this argument period. It'd be in by the end of June. But they could decide before that. They could potentially decide after that. But we wait to see, you know, where Justice Kennedy is. We've been waiting for, I guess, 13 years. People who watch this issue have been wondering, has he changed? What that means for Wisconsin's 2018 elections, we don't know. Even if plaintiffs prevailed, there's a possibility that Wisconsin's map would remain in place for November of 2018.
Yeah, June potentially a long way off, so some waiting to do for us. Sean, thanks
lots of shows about this.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us from Washington, D.C. to talk about the Wisconsin redistricting case that's being heard in the U.S. Supreme Court. Coming up, our guest is taking on the issue of partisan redistricting with geometry. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, the U.S. Supreme Court, as we just heard, is taking a first look at Wisconsin's partisan redistricting case this week. As lawyers make their case in D.C., a group of citizens is coming together to fight gerrymandering. Our next guest is a mathematician at Tufts University specializing in geometry. She founded the Geometry of Redistricting Summer School there, which now has satellite events around the country, including Wisconsin. The idea to bring together mathematicians, data analysts, legal scholars, and political scientists to use their expertise to combat gerrymandering. The next event is coming in October 12th through 15th in Madison with a workshop and conferences. Some events will be open to the public. Moon Duchin joins us now. She is a professor of math at Tufts University, specializing in geometry, and she's the founder of the Geometry of Redistricting Summer School. Moon, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Well, where did you first get this idea to use geometry and take a whack at redistricting and partisan redistricting and create the summer school?
Well, I'm certainly not the first person to have the idea. It's really quite an old idea in American politics that ugly shaped districts are a tip-off of some kind of agenda behind the drawing of the map. You know, even the original gerrymander back from 1812 political cartoon embodies that idea. If the shape looks like a reptile, it's probably not very fair. The problem is, if you look at the history of how this has been handled in courts, nobody has ever really come up with a convincing idea of what makes a shape good, what makes a shape bad, so that you can throw out bad maps on the basis of shape. I personally came to the problem through teaching a voting course during the presidential election, the primaries in 2016. I thought I'd do a little unit for my students where we'd look at shapes of voting districts, and the more I got into it, the more I realized that modern geometry has a contribution to make.
And what is that contribution?
Well, so in a nutshell, I would say this. The shape analysis of voting districts has usually been done just by looking at their outlines on a map. And today we know that you can get really far with what you might call discrete geometry. So instead of just looking at the blob or the Rorschach blot, you actually want to look at the network of where the people are and how the populations are interconnected into communities. And that gives you a kind of graph or a network that shows you a lot more about what's going on with the people. And then you can apply geometric ideas like curvature and eigenvalues and a whole host of other ideas to the network.
So it sounds, to my ear, and I'm not a mathematician, it sounds complicated, and I think that can be one of the hurdles is, you know, you look at those making a case before the Supreme Court or anyone interested in the subject is, how do you explain this in a way that might be a little more simple and elegant? Is there a way to do that?
Well, absolutely. So here's a nice way. Fundamentally, the thing about the gerrymandering problem is that it's just complicated, and there are so many factors that go into a map. If you think about it in terms of all the choices that you make when you're drawing a districting map, it's an unthinkable, more than astronomical number of choices for how to take a state like Wisconsin and take its wards and divide them up into districts. That's actually just, you can't even think about the space of all the possibilities. So one really beautiful way to take complicated ideas and present them persuasively is going on these days using computer algorithms to sample. So here's the principle. If I get a computer to crawl around and make millions of alternative maps, lots of different ways of cutting up Wisconsin, and then I study how they turn out politically. So in a case on partisan gerrymandering, maybe I'd look for how many Republican seats you get in the assembly out of 99. So what will happen out of those millions of possibilities is you'll get a bell curve that shows all the different ways it could turn out. And then you look at Act 43, at the current assembly's plan, and you'll see it's all the way out on a tail of the bell curve. It's not in the fat part. It's an outlier. It's out at the extreme in terms of more Republican seats than the great bulk of most of the plans. I think that provides a pretty approachable and pretty understandable visual representation that the legislature's plan is extreme.
Looking at this from a mathematician's perspective, we've been hearing about some of the ways that those before the U.S. Supreme Court are making this case. And one is by looking at something called an efficiency gap. We just heard about that. Do you think that that is an effective way to approach this?
Well, it's interesting. So I think that the geometry approach and the distribution approach are complementary. So geometry says bad districts have funny shapes, you know, in its simplest form. And efficiency gap is saying, let's pay attention to how people are distributed. It looks at, as you know, it looks at something called wasted votes with the idea that a bad map will disperse or over-concentrate the people out of power. And I think any competent analysis of a plan has to do both things together. It has to do geometry and it has to do statistics. So I think efficiency gap is a really cool idea, but it's only a beginning to the conversation. One of the things that I really was encouraged to see in the court documents for this case that opens today, in the motion to appeal, you'll see that the plaintiffs say, this isn't all about the efficiency gap. That's just one of many possible ways to see that a plan is too extreme. I completely agree with that.
We're talking with Moon Duchin right now, a math professor at Tufts University specializing in geometry. She's also the founder of the Geometry of Redistricting Summer School. And Moon, you take people from various disciplines to approach this problem. Math is one of them, also political science, legal scholarship, data analysis. What can bringing that group of people together to take a look at this, what can that do that looking at a single approach might not be able to do?
Oh, yeah, that's great. So far, it's just been enormously constructive, I think. We're seeing people from different disciplines, and they're really engaging with ideas from across the aisle. You know, take math in particular. One of the stereotypes of mathematicians is that they're eggheads shut up in a room who don't know anything about the real world, right? And that can be true sometimes. But in this case, we want to get the mathematicians actually thinking about how to have ideas that fit the legal framework and ideas that activate the political values that we share in a democracy. So you can't do that in isolation. You really need to have interdisciplinary kinds of cooperation.
And are you seeing big ideas come out of these meetings, not just at Tufts, but there's a similar event coming up in Wisconsin at UW-Madison. There's also an event like this in California and Texas. Are you seeing big ideas come that you think have a viable chance of explaining this thing?
Absolutely. There are a few papers already in the preprint stage that came out of the meeting at Tufts. So that's already very exciting to me, people collaborating, people from different backgrounds working together and getting scholarship out into print. Also, the teacher training aspect of what we're doing is getting lots of traction, I think, in classrooms, and that's a wonderful way to reach many, many people. So I think, you know, taking this multi-pronged approach, we're able to have a lot more kind of penetration into different settings and discourses. And I'm really optimistic that we're going to come up with some new and really usable ideas.
Now, in the past, Justice Kennedy has hinted that the right kind of metric might convince him on this issue. Do you think it is possible to come up with this litmus test, maybe one that's before the court right now that satisfies everybody?
Well, I'll tell you what I would like to see happen, and I think it's not impossible. I don't expect, nor do I hope for, the efficiency gap to be, you know, enshrined as the one answer here. I don't think that's likely to happen. But what really could happen is the courts could finally come up with an outlier framework. They could say, in the past they've said partisan gerrymandering is justiciable. It's something we can think about, but we don't know how to measure it. I'd like to think that now they could be persuaded that computers have finally caught up with the problem and that this big ensemble of alternative maps as a pool to compare a plan against, that really points the way forward. And let me clarify, you know, they're not, I don't think, likely to say what the threshold would be, how far out the tail of the bell curve you have to be bad, but that's okay. We have lots of cases where the court has given a framework with details to be filled in later. And here I really hope that they take this computer sampling approach with an outlier analysis as the framework moving forward. That would just be a huge step forward for the gerrymandering problem.
And Moon, only about 30 seconds left, but it sounds like you have a plan to get some new maps out there before the 2020 census. What's the goal?
That's right. We want to be ready when the new census data drops to draw lots of neutral maps for all the states and have them on record so that legislatures can use them as tools and as benchmarks.
Moon, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great. I hope to see people at our workshop in Madison.
That was Moon Duchin, professor of math at Tufts University. She specializes in geometry, and there are now several of these geometry redistricting summer schools going on. There's one coming up in Madison, a similar version of that, at UW-Madison, October 12th through the 15th, and some of those events are open to the public. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the politically divisive Facebook ads that were posted by Russians pretending to be Americans before and after the election. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time. Facebook turned over 3,000 Russia-linked ads to congressional investigators this week. The social media giant recently shared details on the ads and posts as investigators look into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Investigators believe Russians who posed as Americans on Facebook were part of a Kremlin-linked propaganda group to spread disinformation. Facebook executive Joel Kaplan said that the accounts posted content that amplified divisive issues across the political spectrum. About 10 million people are believed to have seen the ads. Amy Webb is a professor of strategic foresight at New York University and a futurist who researches emerging technology. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, Amy, can you give us a sense of what kind of content was posted by these users?
So that's the unusual thing. I think if, you know, we think about Russia using Facebook almost as a weapon against the United States, our thoughts might move into directions of stealing data or, posting a ton of fake news. That's pretty obvious. The reality, though, was that a lot of the fake accounts and the fake groups were much more insidious. There were groups established for people who like dogs. So it was like a whole dog owners group. And, it was very innocuous. So people who are pet owners who love to post photos of their dogs, right? I mean, what could be the harm in that? In that case, that particular account, it accrued quite a few members. They didn't start posting any obviously political content, but it was just a matter of time. But there were other cases shortly after the Freddie Gray tragedy in Baltimore. There was an account that started called Blacktivist, and it was aggressively trying to organize protests within the city of Baltimore. Now, what's interesting in that case is that I live in Baltimore. And so after that you know, after that tragedy, what's so interesting is that the city of Baltimore really did come together, and there was an active movement within the city against protests because, you know, the city was trying to sort of keep things together. And by city, I mean citizens of the city, not at a governmental level. And so this account was going around trying to incite violence within the city of Baltimore to the point where the Reverend Heber Brown, who's a local, very, very well-known and very, very well-respected preacher in the city of Baltimore, kind of got into an argument with this account saying, hey, you know, I don't know where all this, you know, organizing is coming from. We are organized for peace, not for protests. Can you, are you an outsider? Where are you from? And whoever was in charge of that page said, well, yeah, I'm somebody who supports the cause. I don't live in Baltimore. But pretty quickly it became apparent that the person was not a native English speaker, although, you know, not everybody was paying attention. So these two, you know, the page for dog lovers and the page that was, I guess, supposed to incite protests in Baltimore, they don't seem like they have a direct link to the election, right? And that's what a lot of the concern is right now. However, they fit this pattern of widespread social unrest and confusion. And so there have been hundreds upon hundreds of different accounts that have been created on Facebook, groups that have been created on Facebook, but the same thing is happening on Twitter. And the goal is to confuse people, to pit people against each other, and in general to cause a sense of anxiety and unease.
And is this something that investigators have now put their finger on? Has it stopped now at this point?
So that's a great question. Who investigates, right? I mean, it could be argued that, in a sense, you know, Facebook is the largest intelligence agency on the planet. And, you know, that would rival the CIA, and that might even rival the KGB. And it's powerful because we are willingly inserting all of our private details and all of our data into the service. The question is, who oversees that service? So, you know, there were folks within the State Department about a year ago who were looking into some of this. There were people within our different law enforcement agencies who, you know, on the fringes, had heard that maybe something like this was possible and people had started looking into it. But we don't have a single sort of oversight body that sort of tracks these gray areas, right? Because technically, did Facebook break a law by allowing people from Russia to buy ads targeting Americans with misinformation? You know, the answer is no. However, we see now the second, third, fourth order, you know, implications that have resulted, you know, in the wake of all of this. So that's a good question. You know, which law enforcement agency has been looking into it? And the answer is, you know, there isn't a single one, and there isn't also a coordinated effort.
It's believed that over 10 million people saw some of these ads, and they didn't just come before the election. Many of them came after the election as well, a little more than half from what I've seen. But is there a sense of what kind of influence the ads had?
Sure. You know, and again, nobody has the data. Facebook claims that it itself doesn't necessarily have all the data, which I find fascinating. But 10 million to me seems like a gross, you know, if it really is only 10 million people, then either Facebook has been grossly over-reporting the numbers of people using the system, or that is a gross understatement. I think what's far more likely is that there were many, many more people who at some point or another saw either the kind of ad or the kind of post that we've been talking about, or something that came from what would appear to be a reputable agency. So there are a lot of people who share posts from a website called RT, and the RT logo is green. My sister, a couple months ago, sent me, it was something about Viking cats, Viking kitties, and it was a story about scientists had discovered cats came over with the Vikings. And if you were a cat person, this was a great story for you. Except that it came from Russia Today. Russia Today is widely believed to be a arm of the Russian government, a propaganda arm. And, you know, they have plenty of content now on television. They have a website. They act as though they are news organizations. However, a lot of the content that they post is questionable. And, you know, I've seen a ton of Russia Today posts on my Facebook feed. My question is, am I being counted as one of the 10 million who were targeted? And I think that the answer is probably no, right? I'm not being counted, although clearly, you know, I saw some of that content as well.
Talking to Amy Webb right now, professor of strategic foresight at NYU, and she researches how technology will transform the way we live. And we're talking about Facebook having alleged Russian profiles, posting many ads seeming to be aimed at creating a sense of political division and unrest, maybe undermining democracy in the United States. And looking at whatever goal that Russians might have had to disrupt, to sow seeds of chaos and distrust, is it looking as though they were successful in that aim or are currently?
Right. So, you know, the challenge, this is where things get really complicated. So, you know, I went to summer camp in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, because I'm originally from the Midwest. And at the time that I went to summer camp, my parents sent me copies of the Chicago Tribune. There weren't a lot of other ways to get news. You know, the challenge in the year 2017 is that news comes from every direction. And it took news organizations quite a while to figure out how to get folks to keep paying for content, because it costs money to create quality journalism. You know, and quality journalism used to not just be available for free everywhere. The challenge is that news organizations dragged their heels, never really came up with a sustainable business model. And so in the wake of that, we have all of these alternate news sources. Some of them are completely legitimate and credible. Some of them aren't. You know, journalists use a pretty standard formula to write their content, and even at NPR, you know, there are certain ways that you have intros, you have lead-ins. And it's not like these formulas are kept under lock and key. So what's happening is, you know, it's easy to parody. That's why the people who read The Onion stories, right, the reason they're so funny is because we recognize the formula and it turns the story in a different direction. The other side of that is that you can do the very same thing with news that isn't accurate news but sounds like it might be. And it's become very easy to share all of that on Facebook and on Twitter. And at the same time, news organizations are finally now starting to put up paywalls. So rather than going to your local news website, in my case, you know, where I grew up, the Chicago Tribune, you know, or one of the many fine news organizations in Wisconsin, instead of going to those websites, people are instead sort of looking at the links that are being passed around. And it's not always clear what is fake from what is real. And one of the bigger problems is that, you know, some of these fake news, some of these fake accounts looked as though they were spreading, you know, what seemed to be accurate news reports from what appeared to be legitimate news websites. But if you spent a few minutes, you know, somebody like with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, right? If you're not from Wisconsin, you don't know that that's the name of the local newspaper. If you're from, I don't know, some other state, let's say Maryland, and you get to something that says the Milwaukee Sentinel Journal, right? A local in Wisconsin would know that that's not the right name, but somebody else wouldn't. And if it looks and feels like the news and it follows that pattern, then people will click. And the problem is that that's where a lot of, that's why this problem is so difficult and it's so complicated. And it's hard to just shut off the tap because it's coming from everywhere.
We're talking with Amy Webb right now. She's a professor at NYU and a futurist who researches emerging technology. And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Did you see any of the Russia-linked Facebook ads? How much did what you saw on Facebook affect the way that you voted or your political views? And what role do you think Facebook should play in politics? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Amy Webb. She's a professor at NYU and a futurist who researches emerging technology. We're looking at news that Kremlin-linked ads were a part of a coordinated Russian disinformation campaign before and after the election. And you can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Did any of the Russia-linked content on Facebook affect you, at least as far as you know? And do you think Facebook should be doing more to prevent disinformation campaigns designed to sway American politics? And tell us what you think social media giants like Facebook, like Twitter, should have, whether they should have more government oversight. Call us at 800-642-1234. And we'll go to our first caller. Now we've got Brad with us in Madison. Brad, hi.
Hi. This is a great topic. I'm very interested in this topic. I'm a psychology professor at a community college, and one of the things that I noticed that I'm sure you've studied a lot is that we just haven't developed the skill set to live in this new kind of information overload society. You know, way back when I grew up, I had to seek information out. I had to go to the library to find it. And now it's coming at everybody all the time. And the students that I work with are just, you know, they're falling into the confirmation bias. There's just so much that they don't have to know kind of what's right or what's wrong, so they just decide to leave what makes the most sense to them.
Brad, thanks a lot for that comment. I think an insightful one that maybe we haven't, our brains haven't caught up with the technology. Brad says we don't have the skill set yet to deal with the amount of information out there. Do you think that's right, Amy?
Absolutely, it's right. And I'm so happy Brad called in and made that point, because I think what happens is every time we have a new wave of technology or a new generation of people intersecting with information, there's a tendency to sort of say, well, these young kids, they just don't have patience. They just, you know, they're lazy, or any other any other comment that we've all heard throughout our lifetimes. But Brad brought up a really great point. The key difference in the year 2017 is that the technology that we intersect with in our everyday lives and the volume of information that we have access to through that technology is unprecedented in human history. And the challenge is that we haven't developed the skill set to take in that information as quickly as it's coming to us, and we don't have as much time to sit and think critically and to ask important questions and to be skeptics in a productive way before seeing the next piece of information. And adding to all of this is the chemical effect on our brains. So one of the problems is that every time, for example, if you're on Twitter, every time our president sends out a new tweet, you know, it's always something, regardless of where you fall in the political spectrum, that tweet is always something interesting, right? And in a sense, it acts like a shot of dopamine. And so we tend to click, you know, more and more and more, and we go to that social media feed on Facebook, you know, with increasing frequency, because our brains have become accustomed to that hit of dopamine.
So you're saying we're kind of like the rats pressing down on the lever
right,
for the pellet of reward.
That's absolutely right. And so we have cognitive biases that we've developed that are becoming harder and harder to chase away. And, you know, few people are even aware that they have them, which again is why if you saw, for example, on Facebook, the Defend the Second ad, so this was it was published all over Facebook. It was talking about defending the Second Amendment, why you have a gun, why this person has a gun. It was pretty viral and pretty popular. We instinctively either clicked on it and put a heart there, or clicked on it and put an angry face there, or we, you know, shared it with vitriol, or we shared it with huge enthusiasm, in part because of this chemical response. And that was an ad that did not come from the United States. It came from Russia.
I want to take another caller now. And again, thanks to Brad for that. Let's go next to Debbie joining us in Sheboygan. Debbie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think stemming the tide of information on Facebook is going to be very, very, very difficult, if not almost impossible, because of the social network that it is, that there's so many people in the country that are utilizing Facebook, and they share all the information, whether it's factual or not factual, without checking to make sure what they're sharing is indeed anything of substance.
Debbie, thank you for that thought. Debbie saying that maybe the horse is already out of the barn. It's hard to get all the information under control at this point. It's used so widely. And that also kind of gets at the question whether how much culpability Facebook has in what happened and what will happen in the future, Amy.
That's right. So to her point, it's not like we can just shut the tap off, right, on a lot of this without turning the network dark. There are technological ways around this. So, you know, Facebook could tweak its algorithm. It could tweak some of the ways that it manages data to prevent, for example, some of these fake ads or most of these fake ads. It could also, and the same thing goes for Twitter. Twitter could, again, by tweaking its algorithm and its technology, could pretty easily stop the proliferation of bots and the spread of fake news. But what we've learned over the past year is that we click, right? We click on this stuff. And so there's a business case, even if there's not a democratic case, there's a business case to keeping a lot of these systems going just as they are right now. Now, to the culpability issue, that's where things get murky. Facebook continues to say that it is just a platform and that, you know, similarly to Amazon, all they're doing is offering the sort of middleware service between consumers and sellers, right? The challenge, however, is that Facebook's algorithm governs what we see when. And I think you could argue easily that that algorithm is performing the same services as an editor. Therefore, for Facebook to continue to say that it's not in the content business, I think, is kind of disingenuous. And to that question of culpability, how could they not be culpable at this point?
I've got a question from Mark in Madison that gets at this. He said, is there a way for social media sites to authenticate these new sites to help people?
So, you know, I think that there is. Earlier in the year, I wrote, I explained all of this in a story on Mother Jones, and it's still online, and you can take a look. And the way to do this would be to add some snippets of code to basically have a spectrum of verification. Because, just as an example, Breitbart News, you know, is very much on the right. It's a conservative news site. And sometimes they publish news that's disingenuous. Sometimes they publish news that's factually accurate. It just happens to not be what some people agree with. And the same could be true for news organizations on the far left, MSNBC, for example. You know, they publish content that's factually accurate. It just may not match up with your ideas. So one thing that could be done would be to verify across the globe all credible sources of information. And when it's credible, you get a badge, just like we see verified badges now on Facebook and Twitter. And it gives you a sense. This is a middle-of-the-road publication. This is a right-leaning or left-leaning. But this story is, you know, factually accurate. And to verify it, you don't need lots of humans at Facebook doing this. You just need to go through the process with the news organizations themselves. But it would be a step that would limit, you know, it would limit a lot of this scandalous stuff that we're seeing all over the place. And as a result of that, it would probably limit some of those dopamine hits that we're getting. And it may cause us to click less. So there's possibly a business disincentive here.
Amy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Is Amy Webb, a professor of strategic foresight at NYU and a futurist who researches emerging technology. She joined us to look at Facebook's involvement in the Russia investigation after news that Russia-linked Facebook ads were part of a disinformation effort. And we'd love to hear more about what you have to say on this. How much blame should Facebook take? Mark Zuckerberg says he wants to unify people, do better. What would doing better look like for Facebook? What do you want to see? And how influenced were you? Are you a little more careful now? You can let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. If you're a fan of the movie Mean Girls, you know exactly what day today is.
On October 3rd, he asked me what day it was.
It's October 3rd.
2 weeks later, we spoke again.
It's raining.
Yeah.
Clip there from Mean Girls. Well, today is October 3rd, and to fans of the hit movie by Tina Fey, it means it's Mean Girls Day. Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson is here in the studio to tell us about why is this day a big deal, JC?
So, I mean, I guess I'm going to have to admit really quickly that I am a millennial. So Mean Girls was pretty big for people in my age demographic. It was the height of Lindsay Lohan, Tina Fey was exploding. It was just kind of the perfect confluence of, you know, those two talents. But it was just one of those cultural moments that has really resonated, I think, through the years. Anytime it's on TV, I'm watching it. It's just one of those amazing films. And yeah. I've been seeing memes about it all today, mean girl memes. So it's just a really, I don't know how to describe it really.
I've only watched maybe, let's say, 20 minutes when I catch it on cable at a hotel or something like that. Is it worth watching? Is it going to resonate with me, a non-millennial?
Absolutely. It is extremely funny. It's a wonderful sort of coming of age film that I think a lot of people should, you know, watch when they get a chance.
All right. One to watch. This is Central Time.